Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, July 30th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Right-wing Idaho Family Policy Center wants to reintroduce mandatory Christian prayers for K through 12 students in public classrooms. Idaho lawmakers convene their own version of DOGE, whooping cough outbreak in Whitman County, and we'll hear from Ward 3 candidates for Pullman City Council at a League of Women Voters Forum ahead of next Tuesday's primary. All that coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And this is KRFP Moscow Pullman and live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho. I'm Lee Robartis and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Whitman County Public Health reported a pertussis outbreak Friday. The disease is also called whooping cough. It is highly contagious and especially dangerous to infants under the age of one. Pertussis starts with cold-like symptoms and then turns into a severe cough. If the disease is diagnosed early enough, doctors can treat it with antibiotics to reduce the risk of spreading. People with pertussis should isolate until they have completed 5 days of antibiotic treatment or stay home for 21 days after symptoms appear to avoid spreading the disease. The Idaho Family Policy Center, which has become the largest conservative lobbying group in the state, plans to reintroduce their bill mandating Christian Bible readings every morning in public schools. The group's bill, filed during last year's legislative session, failed to get traction. Idaho Family Policy Center Executive Director Blaine Canzati told Investigate West, "It usually takes 2 or 3 years to get a bill through. We're going to introduce it again next year, and I am confident and optimistic in the chances of success." Far-right Christian nationalists who want to elevate their religion over other faiths and over people who do not practice religion say they are emboldened by recent Supreme Court decisions that seem to allow religious supremacist policies to move forward. The U.S. Supreme Court has considered mandatory Bible readings in public schools unconstitutional for 60 years. The Bible readings would also violate the Idaho Constitution's Blaine Amendment. The Policy Center has also announced it will open a law firm to help people sue to enforce laws that Canzati wrote. The Idaho Family Policy Center has written and successfully pushed Idaho's most controversial laws, including the bill making it a felony to perform an abortion even if the health of the mother is at risk due to pregnancy complications, the ban on puberty blockers, and the law allowing the public to sue libraries or schools if they expose youth to books that lawmakers consider harmful. Investigate West reports nearly two-thirds of the Idaho Family Policy Center's board members have ties to Moscow-based Christ Church, run by local pastor Doug Wilson. That includes Wilson's former assistant pastor Toby Sumpter, parish elder and July 4th parade organizer Jason Elmore, and Israel Waitman, who is on the board of New St. Andrews College. Trump Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who is a member of one of Christ Church's hundreds of satellite congregations nationwide, was the main speaker at a Idaho Family Policy Center gathering last year. Western State Center Program Manager Liz Yates calls the Idaho Family Policy Center's goals anti-democratic. Yates said, "They are trying to install a theocracy in which the authority of government comes not from the people, but from the Bible, and people who don't subscribe to that form of Christianity are the ones who are excluded." Progressive former Boise pastor Ben Creamer said he's not on board with Christian nationalism. Cream said, "You don't see Jesus going around imposing by law that people of other faiths listen to his scriptures. That is theologically and morally repugnant to me." Idaho Planned Parenthood lobbyist Misty Delicarpini-Tolman says the Family Policy Center laws have her fearing for transgender members of her family. Deli Carpini Tolman said, "We're trying to live our lives. They're using LGBTQ Idahoans' lives in order to get their political wins. And the harm that I've seen in the past 2 years is like nothing I've seen." Kanzati said during a 2022 podcast, "Our founding fathers didn't like democracy. Some of them called it demonic and satanic because it so often degenerates into mob rule." Asked about Christchurch's involvement in the Idaho Family Policy Center during an interview yesterday, Sons of Patriarchy podcast co-producers Sarah Bader of Moscow and Peter Bell of California said the church's influence on Idaho's politics is of concern.
As Moscow residents, exceedingly disappointed in a state that we love dearly. We are watching Doug Wilson's dream come true from our little town that is so full of beautiful things and beautiful people. So I think you understand the disappointment that I personally feel every time we face this. I think you understand the overwhelming difficulties we face because it's not just Christchurch. They've influenced an entire evangelical movement. We've watched from Moscow grow outwards, and they have gotten their political allies, bombastic people like Dan Foreman, who is just idiotic and insane, but they use him for his methods. And the Quiverful movement is very important. Having a lot of children is very important. And so we are seeing those changes happen in Idaho. And I think that, you know, we're going to just have to hope for the best at this point. It's a really rough go.
Yeah, and I want to speak to this even as a Christian myself, and Sarah has her just as equally valid perspective as an atheist, which is Sons of Patriarchy is composed of atheists and Christians,
yes,
all talking about this stuff together. But even as a Christian, I would never support Bible reading mandated Bible reading in schools. I have nothing against kids bringing their own Bibles in class and reading their own Bibles on their own time. But it's both a separation of church and state and also an individual conscience thing. If you tell Christian nationalists, hey, would you mind institutionalized readings of the Quran or institutionalized readings of the Gita, Mahabharata Gita, whatever it's called, the Buddhist text? Would you want the Book of Mormon from Latter-day Saints? If we don't want any of these in our school, then we should have none of these in our school mandated. But if you want to bring on your own, I have no problem somebody bringing their own stuff and reading their own stuff and talking about their own stuff. But the second that you mandate it, it both violates the church-state separation and the individual conscience stuff within Christian orthodoxy. It violates our own principles as Christians, and it violates principles as just citizens of both Idaho and the United States.
That was Sons of Patriarchy podcast host Peter Bell. And before that, you heard from Sons of Patriarchy podcast co-producer Sarah Bader speaking with KRFP yesterday. Peter Bell and one of the... Peter Bell will be coming to Moscow during the Christchurch Grace Agenda Festival Friday, August 8th, to record an episode of the podcast before a live audience at the Kenworthy Performing Arts Center, followed by a one-hour question-and-answer session. The event will also include Sarah Stancorb, the author of the 2021 Vice article called Inside the Church, that preaches wives need to be led with a firm hand, and who wrote the book Disobedient Women. The event will be on Friday, August 8th at 4 p.m. at the Kenworthy in downtown Moscow. KRFP will broadcast the full interview with Peter Bell and Sarah Bader on Friday's Evening Report, and the Sons of Patriarchy podcast is heard on KRFP Saturdays at 2 p.m. with additional episodes Tuesday nights at 11 p.m. Idaho legislators met Friday to discuss the state executive agency consolidation and readjustments. This comes 3 months after the legislature's April decision to create Idaho's version of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. Legislative Services Office review team member Jared Tatro opened the meeting with an overview of the historic reorganization of the state's executive branch. In 1972, then-Governor Cecil Andrus implemented what Tatro called the last major reorganization effort, under which officials consolidated all but seven of Idaho's 268 state agencies into 20 departments. Lawmakers then imposed a hard limit of 20 departments, which has remained in effect until today. However, there are more than 200 subunits. The Idaho Press reports the lawmakers in Boise invited Arkansas Public Employee Retirement System Executive Director Amy Fetcher to explain her state government's recent efforts. A 2015 inquiry turned into a 2016 office, which turned into a 2017 advisory board, and that turned into a 2019 law consolidating Arkansas's 42 cabinet-level agencies into only 15. Officials organized the state's 200 boards and commissions under those 15 agencies. As Arkansas's executive reorganization predated the coming of DOGE, officials made no explicit efforts to track the state's savings. Fetcher said this was to the chagrin of the Arkansas legislature, and she suggested Idaho's DOGE make tracking savings a core function of their efforts. Members of the public who testified at the meeting were largely supportive of the DOGE task force. Serge Brown, however, questioned whether Idaho's DOGE was stepping into ground best handled by the legislature's existing Office of Performance Evaluations, an independent nonpartisan office tasked with evaluating whether state programs are efficient and cost-effective. Republican Representative Heather Scott of Blanchard said, "I would encourage you to be patient with us and let us let the system work, and I truly believe you're going to see some big things out of this committee." You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by listeners like you and by Palouse Prairie Charter School, an EL Education accredited expeditionary learning model school serving students in northern Idaho. PPCS is a free public charter school that combines hands-on learning, rigorous academics, outdoor adventure, and character development. PalouseProairieSchool.org. Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Moscow Contemporary, which connects, supports, and creates community through art and arts education. Moscow Contemporary is located at 2012 West Pullman Road and moscowcontemporary.org.
The new GOP tax and spending law could increase the risk of massive wildfires by stripping critical national forest system funding and increasing logging on National Park Service lands. That's according to a new analysis by the Center for Economic Policy Research. Lead author Matt Sedler says the new law removes $450 million needed to manage forests not owned by the federal government or states.
It removes funding from a competitive grant program called the Landscape Restoration Program. And what that does is it sets aside money for states, localities, tribal governments, and private landowners to conduct forest management on their land.
In addition to reducing wildfire risk, the grant program helps protect fish and wildlife habitats, maintain or improve watersheds, and mitigate invasive species, infestation, and disease. The Trump administration defends its funding cuts by claiming they will reduce waste, fraud, and abuse. The annual costs of wildfires in the U.S. range from $394 to $893 billion each year. Sedler says even Idahoans who don't live in wildfire-prone zones are feeling those costs and rising insurance premiums. In the state, home insurance rates increased 45% between 2019 and 2024. He believes programs that prevent wildfires are money well spent.
When you're talking about cutting 0.01% of the budget and it prevents those types of fires, then what kind of waste are you actually getting rid of? It seems like we're creating more costs for the American people and not getting rid of waste.
The new law also claws back funding for environmental reviews conducted by the U.S. Forest Service. The Trump administration says they take too long and slow development. Sedler says the administration's recent decision to cancel rules that prohibited development on roadless areas of the national park system could also increase wildfire risks.
By rescinding that rule and then removing environmental reviews, they're opening up a lot of areas to development within the national parks. And there's a lot of research out there that shows that logging increases wildfire risk, mostly due to the waste that's left over.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The coaches of the Renton School District, just south of Seattle, are organizing with the American Federation of Teachers to fight for what they say are fair wages in their first union contract. Buddy Ryan is the head boys track and field coach at Hazen High School. He says Renton coaches get paid much less compared to neighboring school districts, which contributes to a 45% turnover rate in coaches from year to year.
I'm not expecting to go buy a new car off a season of coaching, but I'm not expecting to make minimum wage to be responsible for all these kids. And I think the reality is a fair wage for a fair day's work is what everybody looks for.
Renton School District has proposed a 2.5% wage increase, far below what the coaches asked for. AFT says the district has the funds to pay coaches fairly. The district did not respond to a request for comment. Ryan says the low pay and high turnover rate costs the district more money in training and degrades the quality of the sports programs.
And then what's the cost to the kids that get a different coach every year? Well, you know what ends up happening? These parents get tired of it and they take their kids to private schools or they move and transform to other schools.
Ryan notes that sports, along with other extracurriculars like band, are what motivate many kids to keep their grades up in order to participate. He says the district should want to keep the program strong.
It's just like when you're a kid at dinner and your parents say you got to eat your vegetables or you don't get dessert. Well, that dessert is the after school activities.
I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
We now bring you the second part of the Pullman League of Women Voters candidate forums for Ward 3 Pullman City Council candidates who are running in next Tuesday's primary election. Ballots must be postmarked by 5 p.m. next Tuesday in order to count. It is a mail-in election. We aired part one of the League of Women Voters Candidates Forum for the Ward 3 Pullman City Council candidates on the evening report for Friday, July 18th, which is available on the KRFP archive website. And three out of eight candidates for the Ward 3 Pullman City Council seat were on hand for the candidates forum, which was held Wednesday, July 16th. Ward 3 is mainly the southern part of the city. The top two vote-getters in the top two primary will advance to the November general election. The three candidates who answered questions at the forum at Neal Public Library were Shay Ortega, Tony Zumlas, and John Castleman. The other candidates on the ballot are Carl Olson, Federico Bartolo, Michelle Dandy Utzman, Colin Bannister, and Dave Gibney. Two of those candidates were interviewed by KRFP, and those interviews are available on the KRFP website. Also, Olson and Gibney sent messages for the moderator to read at the candidates' forum. We'll now continue with the conclusion of the Ward 3 League of Women Voters Candidates Forum for Pullman City Council Ward 3 seat up for election this year.
Okay, Tony, you get to start this time. As a council member, would you support the expansion of the homeless support programs in Pullman? And follow-up question, would you support a dedicated homeless shelter beyond just crisis and transitional housing?
This is another easy one to answer as a bar owner.
Tony Zumlas.
EMTs or the police so many times late at night because people come into my place looking for warmth or looking for shelter. I don't think that Pullman has done a particularly fantastic job of taking care of people who are in crisis or who are homeless. I absolutely think that Pullman can and should do better in that space.
Next, John Castleman.
I have not yet explored kind of all the costs associated with developing a dedicated homeless shelter. I know that The city had tried a temporary one and tried to staff it with volunteers, and then it was pretty short-lived. Folks weren't able to commit to that on a regular basis. So I think if we're going to do that, that's going to entail significant costs. My approach to my role as a city council member is often going to be coming back to how can we empower citizens to do that work. I think about the Community Action Center. I think, again, I mentioned the Palouse Alliance earlier. How do we get people, how do we get the community members who are already doing the work, how do we empower them to do more of it, to better understand underlying causes and respond rapidly when things change? With the federal government or the state government, things that are outside of our control. So absolutely, I think we need to help the most vulnerable among us first. I think that's incumbent upon us as Pullmanites. We are a welcoming city. We are a city where a lot of people come and go. And so for those of us who are here, who are planted, it's on us to support, those who are less fortunate. Thank you.
Shea Ortega.
I just want to say that many of us, as I said earlier, 75% of us are renters. Many of us are two paychecks away from homelessness. And I've encountered that myself as a single mother. And I 100% support the expansion of our homeless support and a shelter. As a student who was working in basic needs over at WSU, we have a lot more transient students than you think. And we hardly see any of them. Why is that? So we have strong nonprofits in the community who are already doing the hard work. ATVP has been extremely valuable. They work directly with our law enforcement officials, the Center for Civic Engagement, the Community Action Center, WSU's Basic Needs Department. All of these individuals are so short on resources and involvement. We can do better as a city. I have seen what happens when a small rural community falls into disrepair because big investors choose to pull out suddenly when the resource is depleted. We are not far off from that as a rural community. Every rural community is. So let's do better and be preventative about it and address it now.
Thank you. Who started that one?
Oh, okay.
Then Tawny, it's your turn.
Oh, Tawny, yeah, you start.
Okay. Then we start with John again. Okay. How would you increase collaboration with WSU to encourage students' interaction with downtown businesses?
John Castleman.
First, I would start talking to and working with the students. I think, there's, for example, Town Gown. That's one way, but I think we need to open more gates up. I speak on an annual basis with Leadership WSU. It's a group of high-achieving juniors and seniors, and talk to them about this exact issue. You know, raise your hand, step up, find problems and attempt to solve them. You can start doing that now. Working with student, there's hundreds of student associations and groups up on campus who all have our kind of pre-built-in community. So I think finding ways that we can connect those specific groups with our downtown businesses is something that's not far off. You know, I went to the Pullman Market 2 weeks running now, and last weekend I went, and half the people there were students. So I don't think it's an issue of, you know, that we need to make any special appeal. I think it's about, one, let's just do more stuff, and two, really listen to what they want.
Shea Ortega. Shea.
So I don't think I mentioned it, but I am also a PhD student over at WSU in the School of Politics, Philosophy, and Public Affairs. I'm also the college representative for GPSA, which is a Graduate and Professional Students Association. And since I moved here, since day one, I have been working with a lot of different groups in the community, with community members, with business owners, and I have been trying to set up different ways for us to collaborate. Because what I noticed was when I brought something to the attention of either or group, typically the response was, oh, WSU isn't accessible to the community members. The parking is high, it's not physically accessible, and there needs to be changes made there. We need to have our spaces ADA compliant at the very, and they're doing the bare minimum. And so those are my own qualms with the university. But I really feel like locals see the university as this totally other world, and vice versa for the students. A lot of them are international, and they feel like maybe they're not valued as members. So, like I said again, we're not pushing back. We want this to happen. It's already in the works. There are people doing the work. Let's do it.
Tawny Zumras.
All right, yeah, thank you for the question. If you go to Moscow and you go onto the U of I campus, you will find that there are no personal businesses. Those students have to walk into downtown, even if they have to walk 15 or 20 minutes, and they do it without complaining. We need to stop allowing private business on campus so that people have to come in and engage the core of our downtown. And I'm not saying that we get rid of the ones that are there. They're established and they're wonderful. But we cannot allow WSU to keep sucking up all the oxygen in the air. So we need to make sure that there's no more new businesses. We need to find fun and interesting ways to get people downtown. One of the things they don't want is they don't want to get a ticket if they drink too much downtown and then they drive home. So there has to be a different way to get people downtown. And I don't want to run out of my time. I got a million ideas on that, so I'll just stop there.
Okay, Shay, you get the next question. What skill set do you have that you believe the council needs?
Shay Ortega.
I think I have the unique positionality of having lived a lot of different lives. I grew up on the East Coast for the first part of my life, grew up on the West Coast for the second part of my life. I've lived overseas, I've seen a lot of different models, and I've been in a lot of different states of being, from being housing insecure, food insecure, being a student, being in the workforce. And so I've touched a lot of dimensions. And I think that in all of those dimensions, I've always found myself in leadership, which has definitely benefited me in a lot of different ways. So I come from a very diverse background of knowledge. I've really been involved in a corporate setting, but also in a volunteer setting. I've volunteered for almost 3 decades of my life, and I've seen the nitty-gritty of communities and what it takes to uplift the people in those communities. So I really believe that, I've got the connections required to make the city a vibrant place. I also want to say, just using my time to do this, that Tawny is my favorite bartender. And she literally got me through my last 2 years of undergrad. So she's right.
Tawny, you're next.
Tawny, well, Zumlas.
Okay, so my skill set is that I was born and raised here. I spent a lifetime in Pullman and learning about Pullman, and I spent the better part of the last 15 years already pushing Pullman to be better and do better. I go to a lot of different meetings, and I, help to put my ideas out there. I own a business here, so I understand how to deal with the city on that aspect, and I talk to people. I get to talk to everybody all the time, every day. I get to hear what everybody's needs and wants are, and on like a personal level in my business, I know how to respond to those things. I know how to make RICOs better based on what people tell me, and that's why I'm still in business, and I could do that as a city council member as well.
John Castleman.
These aren't traditional skill sets, but I boil it down to courage, creativity, integrity, and compassion. If you know me, I'm a big tent kind of guy. Zebras, elephants, lions, bring them all in. I love hearing from everybody, but it's not just a personal joy. I think that when we bring people together and hear more ideas, the best ideas will emerge. I am compassionate. When I listen to people, I hear their problems, and I do what I can to help solve them. Creativity, in my professional work, I've created partnerships with school districts that you don't see in towns the size of Moscow, Pullman. You see them in West Lafayette, Indiana, Lafayette. I embark on initiatives that I haven't seen models for, but know that they're going to work, and have championed those. And I'll leave there.
Okay, this is our last question. And Tawny, you get to start. In your opinion, what is the number one issue facing Pullman?
Tawny Zumlas.
We are dying economically. We have to figure out a way to rebuild our core, to bring back businesses, to make it a 12-month town, and to get people not only to live here, but to live here. And really spend that money here. It's good for our tax base. It's good for all of Pullman. We don't need to live in Moscow. We need to live here.
John Castleman.
Short term, and what I hear from people, and this is going to be two, improving the business climate. I think things like the downtown project and the bypass are good and needed, but ultimately we need to make it more viable to own and operate a business here in Pullman. That's what's going to bring vitality back to the downtown area. Lost track of the question. Oh, number one issue. Longer term, answering an existential question about our growth. Do we want to grow as a community? If so, we need to be thinking about things like our aquifer. We need to think about encroaching and pushing into farmland, to natural spaces. Are we ready for that conversation? That's what I want to start pushing, is I think we need to get people together. I'm inspired by organizational and communication method. I think about like the Catholic Church, the synods. Let's get the hills together. Let's break into smaller groups so that we have broader representation at each of the four hills, and then let the city councilors take that information and bring it back to the council so we really feel like we're all able to share input and make a decision as a community.
Shay Ortega.
I feel like I said this earlier. I would say that our number one issue is prioritizing growth over stability. It is vital that we have stability for a rural community. I lived for 10 years in the boot heel of Southeast Missouri. I've seen what happens to communities that do not have their own internal community support. It's bad. We need to work on embracing food sovereignty and justice, accessibility for locals, where if big investors pull out, we don't collapse entirely. We should lean into our community gardens, make sure that these are welcoming spaces that can support our local businesses, our local restaurants. I really love the model that Myelina has, where they source things that are local and support their small farmers and their local providers. We should do that on all fronts, not just our longtime businesses who have been here for generations, but our small farmers and our indigenous peoples who know the lands and make us strong. There's a reason why Pullman is so beautiful to live in, why people choose to live here. So let's embrace that and focus on stability and not necessarily economic growth.
Thank you. That's all the questions we came prepared for. So we'll have our closing remarks now. Each candidate has 2 minutes. And we'll start with Tawny. We'll go backwards this time.
All right.
Tawny Zumlas.
Thank you, everybody that's up here. This is hard. And everyone did a really good job. And thank you to everyone who came, and thank you to the Women League of Voters, Women Voters. I am not someone who just talks about downtown Pullman or Pullman. I am someone who is Pullman. My business sits at the center of everything, and it's more than a place to grab a drink or a bite to eat. It is a gathering space where people can come to celebrate and connect. Every day, people walk through my doors to talk about what's going right and what's going wrong in this city because they trust me. They trust me not because I asked for it, but because I put the hard work in to earn it. This campaign isn't a career step for me. It's a continuation of that work that I do every day, serving the people of this city, helping them feel heard, and fighting for a vibrant, livable town. I think that we need... But we don't need decisions made by people who are disconnected from the street-level reality of Pullman. We need someone who has skin in the game, whose livelihood depends on the success of this town. I am not running to learn on the job. I'm running because, in a lot of ways, I'm already doing the job. And I will take this commitment and passion for Pullman with me.
John Castleman.
I'm running for city council because I believe we need bolder leadership, as a lot of the questions that had come up before addressed. We're losing good people. We're losing businesses. I look back at prior forums, and we ask a lot of the same questions, make a lot of the same promises, and we've been doing that for 20 years. So I think it's time that we take more decisive action, but that we don't just do that blindly. I think we really need to understand the problems that we're facing in Pullman, meaning that we need to go back and look at data, work with our various groups that many of were mentioned tonight, whether it's the Center for Civic Engagement at WSU, whether it's the Chamber of Commerce. We need to understand where we're at and where we fit into this bigger ecosystem. We compare ourselves to other cities. How valid are those comparisons? That's what we need to find out first. Additionally, Pullman's got a lot of good things going on. You know, there are committees right now. Megan Guido leading the housing committee is going to pass that work to Eric Fajerin. There's the bypass committee. There's folks working on good stuff now. I think we need to get ourselves together as a community, pick that goal, and work toward it together using the city council, community organizations, individuals working toward that same goal, and that's what I'm going to champion. And I think to that last point, I mean, building on the work of those who have come before, there's been a lot of good work that's been done, a lot of good work that's going on now, but we need to move in that direction. And a big part of that too is transparency and communicating to the people. When people know what's at stake and when they know how to get involved, regardless of if they've got an hour a week to give or if they're got it, or if they're able to step up and give all of themselves to city council, that's what we need. We need to find places to fit people in, to work together toward our bigger goals as a community. So lastly, I'll say, big thank you, Deb, and the League of Women Voters. I think it's vital that we have nonpartisan opportunities to discuss these ideas so we can get to solve the problems instead of just bickering. So thank you very much. Believe in Pullman.
Shea Ortega.
Yes, thank you so much to the League of Women Voters. I come to your events all the time, so it's weird to be up here. But I've also met a lot of you in the audience during my time here, not just in a capacity as a candidate, but because I put myself out in the community and I serve with you on different boards, or I volunteer with your organizations that you work so hard to uplift. I really believe that I'm a candidate who embraces all of our groups within our community. Nobody is a stranger to me, and that's my favorite part about being on city council, is that it is totally nonpartisan. I value everybody here because you are what makes Pullman amazing. Now, I'm running because I've already been serving. I've already been doing the hard work, and I was asked by those that I work with and work for to put myself in a position that advocates for all of the Pullman citizens. We can't go stagnant as a community. It takes work. It takes effort. It takes growth in our social vitality. You know, it takes being the change that you want to see in the world, and there is so much happening. Speaking of Megan Guido, she would love to have volunteers down at her new recovery center. But the Palouse is unique. I've been all over the place here, and from the scenery to the people and to the things that the people are doing in their communities, it's amazing. And right now, 25% of our population owns 100% of the town, and it shows. Now, I've engaged in projects that talk about those bigger issues, and they're not just dreams. They're stable, and they work. And so I've engaged in projects that are still existing today. I put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into those projects, and I make sure that in anything I do, that's how much I give. Because I'm not anything without my community. My kids don't have anything unless they have a community to turn to. So please vote for me, but also everyone else is really great too.
That was Shea Ortega, and we've just been listening to the conclusion of the Pullman League of Women Voters Candidates Forum for the Ward 3 candidates who are running in this year's primary. The primary is August 5th, and that's the deadline to get mail-in ballots postmarked in order for them to count. There are also drop-off locations. The three candidates who attended the League of Women Voters Forum for the Ward 3 candidates at Neal Public Library were Shea Ortega, Tony Zumlas, and John Castleman. Other candidates on the ballot for Ward 3 are Carl Olson, Frederico Bartolo, Michelle Dandy Utzman, Colin Bannister, and Dave Gibney. KRFP interviewed several of those candidates, including Carl Olson, Colin Bannister, and those interviews are available on the KRFP website, mainly in the evening report portion. Also, KRFP aired part one of the candidates forum you just heard on the evening report for Friday, July 18th, which is also available on the KRFP website. The top two vote getters will advance to the November general election. There also is a contested primary with a number of candidates for the Ward 1 Pullman City Council seat. Ward 3 is mainly the southern part of the city. The seat is currently held by Megan Guido, who is not running for re-election. The other Ward 3 City Council seat is held by Pat Wright, who has 2 years remaining in her term. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, there is a 20% chance of showers before 8 p.m., otherwise mostly clear tonight, low 61. 30% chance of showers tomorrow, mainly after 5 p.m., sunny, otherwise high 95. Thursday night, 60% chance of precipitation, chance of showers and thunderstorms before midnight, then a chance of showers, mostly cloudy, low 58. And on Friday, 50% chance of showers, with thunderstorms also possible in the afternoon. Partly sunny, high 81. Current temperature is 91 degrees. We had a high of 93 about an hour ago. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. David Katz and Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. We'll now proceed to Flashpoints, which has a truncated version because of fundraising at the main station where it originates. And at 7:30, we'll have Lockdown Mosh Pit. At 8:30, music begins in earnest with Grateful Dead Through the Decades with Arlene. And also live in the studios tonight, we'll have Sounds of the Future, 10 to 11 p.m., so stay tuned.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP, Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. Available online at loveskombucha.com.
For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.